Again, that's the Social Justice Action Center Open House, Tuesday, October 4th, starting at 5:30 p.m. at 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Your credit card slotted and sign it on a dotted. Billionaires have squatted on the magna cum laude. Holla, take my wallet, make the people robotic. Catatonic or harmonic with what they've been allotted. And methodically they plotted against those who fought it. Whole cities are haunted cause her money bag knotted. And dropped the thought product of a Harvard grad upon it. Dollars turn the table, boardroom and periodic. Listen to the sonics going through your electronics. You could catalog it as harmonic or atomic. How's it never went up? I'm in molecules turning to solids. Some pray to the Christ, look to Buddha or Muhammad. Some pray to the crack of a rich man's pocket. The biggest advance was plumbing to the projects. Now the scientific process got hijacked for profits. And flows in the direction of the silver spoon product. We'll get signs for the people when we run the economics.
KBOO Portland. This is Poetic License, and I am your host, Taria Autry. This episode, I have a great special guest, the one and only Boots from The Coup. We're going to be chopping it up, talking about music, life, the art, revolution. It's going to be a great show. You're going to be glad that you listened. That fantastic song you're hearing in the background is The Gods of Science, off their latest album, Sorry to Bother You. Boots, I want to thank you so much for agreeing to make some time for this interview. It's so wonderful to have you on this episode of Poetic License.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, my pleasure. And you know, we've known each other a long time. We met back in the day, the early 90s at San Francisco State. Yeah. And I have these great memories of being in my dorm room, bumping the EP, which was on a cassette tape. Classic times.
Yeah.
So, the first album, you asked me to play violin.
You were on our first album.
Which
came after the EP.
Yes.
So.
Which I appreciate, and I remember being in the studio, and the song was actually I Know You, which was off Kill My Landlord, and that song talks about police brutality, self-defense, and resistance, and shortly after we recorded that song, the incident happened with Rodney King, where the public saw a videotape repeatedly of police brutality. So,
yeah.
Here we are, almost 25 years later. And police brutality is still a very present reality and concern. I'm just curious, can you talk to me a little bit about why you think that's the case?
Well, because police brutality is connected to the function of the police. It's not something that can go away on its own. The function of the police, you know, because I've always said that, you know, I'm against the police, even if they, you know, even if they give you a massage and shake your hand before they send you to jail. That's their reason for being is an occupying force, and the police brutality is just symptomatic of that and inseparable. But the point is that there can only be so many people employed under the capitalist system. And there has to be a certain amount of unemployed labor that can form this unemployed army in order to threaten those with jobs with being able to lose their job. For instance, if there was full employment, you would not be able to, you'd be able to demand whatever wages you wanted, and the boss couldn't say, you know, there's someone else coming along to take your job. So this system must operate with unemployment. And that group of folks are gonna also need to eat. So in a capitalist system, that means illegal business, because there's no other way to survive for many people.
Yeah. Cocaine business control America. Ganja business control America. KRS-One still causing hysteria. Illegal business control America. Diamond business control America. The oil business control America. KRS-One still causing hysteria. Illegal business control America.
So the policing of this illegal business is all about, you know, how it connects to the rest of the system, how it connects to legal business. And even the policing for burglaries and, you know, robberies, that has to do with keeping this economic system in place. So you're going to have police brutality as long as you have police. It's, you know, to me, just having so many people of color locked up is an even bigger problem than police brutality. The point is, if you're telling the whole world that crime comes from people making bad choices, as opposed to what it really comes from is people needing to survive under this system. The reason for the painting of what's called crime as being a choice by an individual is so that we don't see that it's connected to this economic system. And part of the painting of that as a choice means that you have to say that, hey, here's this group of people that are making the wrong choices all the time. They're savage, they're brutal, this and that. That's part of selling us the capitalist system. If they didn't, then we'd understand that poverty comes from this system, not from our own choices. And so those without jobs and with jobs might organize to change the way this system works. So you're going to have police brutality as long as you have this system. It's not going to go away. And until we have a different economic system. Besides that, the only way that we have power over any of these factors is by using our actual economic power under the system. And that, I don't mean boycotts, because it's, you can't really exercise your power in that way. You don't know who's buying what, and it's kind of like an opt-in situation. The most effective way to have groups of people have economic exercise their economic power in this system is to have strikes and work stoppages. And until we do that, none of the things, no matter how much we voice our disdain for the way things are, those things aren't going to stop. We can't just yoke those in power into doing the right thing. We have to have organizations and a movement that is able to get masses of people to withhold labor and stop profit in order to demand different changes that we want, even reform changes that we want. Until we start having a movement like that, we're gonna have a lot of the same problems. And until we start having a movement like that, we can't build for a broader revolutionary movement that changes the whole economic system.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland. I am your host, Taria Autry. This is Poetic License. Earlier, you heard clips and background music from KRS-One, Illegal Business, as well as Public Enemy, Shut 'Em Down. We also heard instrumentals from the song Underdogs off Steal This Album by The Coup. I am so excited to share with you this interview with Boots Riley of The Coup. I just want to give you a little warning. There will be some language, which is why I do my show after 10 p.m. The song you're listening to now is called I Know You. It's off the album Kill My Landlord, the very first full album by The Coup, the one that I was lucky enough to play some violin on. You'll hear it in the background.
I know you, motherfucker. My face prints in your knuckles. Hit my head back to the rear and I can hear my knees buckle when you chuckle. As the blow blurred my vision, you make a game trying to tame me for colonialism. The stars and bars all you need to make a perfect prison. No chains or fences here so you can make me think I've risen. I'm giving rations on the 1st and 15th. Just so I won't be out organizing in the street. And so I'm beaten in the court with charges Trump seat. My eye is swollen and my nose looks like Humpty's. But I'm not laughing cause I'll take a bath in this one. The judge is looking at me like he wants to have me hung. I never swung, I got the dung kicked out my ass. Like OPD was using me for beat the nigga class.
Step one, put the handcuffs on. Step two, say something like, nigger, you're gonna learn. Step three, throw him down on the ground. Step four, kick him, of course.
But there's an era in your reign of terror and your end is near. We ain't non-violent no more, so get your riot gear. Stand in fear and guard your rear as we gather round and fuck you up so much they'll have to fuck you down. Assuming the position that you'll have to wear a bulletproof vest on your chest, I suggest you change your address cause we know you.
We know you, motherfucker.
Anywhere I turn,
we know you, motherfucker.
Anywhere I turn,
we know you, motherfucker.
Anywhere I turn, I'm assuming the position.
We know you. We know you, motherfucker.
Anywhere I turn,
we know you, motherfucker.
Anywhere I turn,
we know you, motherfucker.
Anywhere I turn, I'm assuming the position.
You grew up in Oakland, California, the home and founding birthplace of the Black Panther Party. How did growing up there shape your consciousness and your worldview?
You know, it's always hard to answer that because you grew up where you grew up. It's not a petri dish where you can compare it to something else. It's interesting. People ask that question a lot. And I was born in 71. By the time the 80s came around, I was 9. And that's about the time you start becoming more aware of what's happening politically around. And I just remember that by the time I was in high school, because I'd been doing some actions of organizing, the principal said over the loudspeaker, "Don't trust Raymond Riley. He's a communist and he wants to take us back to the days of the Black Panther Party." And the truth is that none of us at school knew who the Black Panther Party was or what they were, why they existed. We didn't know that stuff in Oakland, California. This is by this time, 85, 86, and 5 years to somebody young is a long time.
True.
Right?
Very true.
And the other thing being is that the Panthers, their legacy is bigger than they were at the time. By 1970, most of their rallies were white. This is according to like books by David Hilliard and things like that. And that has to do with, to me, the mistake that they made, that many organizations make, which is having the spectacle be the forefront. And that's not to negate all the other things they did, which was like free breakfast programs and things like that. But people are trying to figure out how to utilize their power to survive. But I will say this, that so we didn't know whatever that the reasons were, because that's my theory on why it wasn't known, but also, you know, the fact that they weren't talked about to us. When we asked the teachers at Oakland High School who the Panthers were, when people were asking, you know, what, because they attacked me by comparing me to the Panthers, several teachers said, oh, the Black Panthers, they were like the black version of the KKK. We didn't have the tools to argue with them because we couldn't cite dates. And matter of fact, there were a few people that were named after Panthers. There were two girls named Erica that were named after Erica Huggins. So I'm saying that to say this, that there's this view of growing up in Oakland that it supposedly just makes you a radical. And it doesn't. It has the same, we have the same problems and struggles with that. They do all over the world. And I think that one of the differences may have been that because of that perception, folks that were radical organizers did try to focus on the Bay Area. And you see that coming out in other ways. But, you know, I think there were radical things going on all over the country. And in the 80s, there were less radical things going on all over the country, you know, so.
Definitely. Yeah. Not too long after we worked on that album, I ended up moving to Chicago. And I remember I was watching one of those video channels, like on cable, that plays music videos all day, like a video jukebox type thing.
Yeah.
And Fat Cat's Big of Fish came on. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, it's Boots and the Coup. Now, that song's off Genocide and Juice, and it talks about a hustler who's like kind of running game in the streets, but then points to the larger hustle, which is that of development and taking over of neighborhoods and this idea of gentrification. So that album came out in 94, and here it is, 2016. Can we talk a little bit about what you've seen transform and change in the city of Oakland?
Well, a lot of people and families that used to live here don't live here anymore. Rent is at such a crazy level that the average job you could get here, you wouldn't be able to afford it. So it's, you know, to a certain extent, it's turning Oakland into a suburb, because you'd have to go somewhere else to work in order to maintain rent for here. So you're working in San Francisco. In order to have a viable art community, and in this case we're talking about, and I'm thinking specifically of music, you have to have cheap rent. So there's less going on music-wise in Oakland, because people have had to move. There are more venues. And we didn't used to have venues. We didn't used to have places that we could perform that, you know, that we didn't have to rent out ourselves. Like we used to rent out union halls or, you know, whatever, a cafeteria of a school, gymnasium, things like that to do shows in Oakland. And now there are venues and we can do those things and you can get some, you know, expensive bourbon or something like that. And, you know, there's some things to that, you know, that you can have a lot of things have gotten fixed up that wouldn't have gotten fixed up before. What's happened is an example of how development does not mean that it's for the people that live in that town. Development has been something that has been put up as the holy grail since the 80s for places like Oakland. Hey, we want this because we want to get developers here. We want to do this. Oh, we've got to reduce crime because that way developers will get here, things like that. And even that, and that is put up as the answer to the problems. Like, we'll get developers in here, we'll get jobs, things like that. But you could possibly make your town to where you get businesses coming in, but they're bringing people with them that they'll hire. They're not hiring people from that area. The things that they're doing are not for the people that live in that area. Like, so for instance, 20 years ago, they built an ice skating rink in Oakland when there still was mostly black folks, and they wouldn't let a roller rink happen.
Are you trying to say that we don't ice skate as much as we roller
not
skate?
As much, no.
No, definitely not.
You know, and then you had certain black business leaders that were like trying to figure out the problem of like, how do we make black owned businesses that black people support? I'm like, okay, well, stop making coffee shops, right?
Mm-hmm.
Make some pool halls. All the places that black folks hang around are places that got demonized.
That's true. There's a stigma around the ways in which we share and occupy space.
Yeah, and those are places that even to this day, like, oh yeah, okay, we'll make a pool hall, but let's make sure the right people come. And even so-called conscious black folks would have made a few spaces in Oakland through the 90s where they discriminated against people that looked like they were from that area. And I had talks with them. One example was when a place called the Upper Room was in San Francisco, and some of those folks are my friends, so we had open discussions about this. But the dude that was running it, who had a lot of great intentions, I saw him one time just not letting some folks that were, this was in San Francisco, not letting some folks that were from the Fillmore in there. And this is in, the place was in Hayes Valley, which is right down the street from Fillmore. And he was just like, nope, it's a private party. Nope, it's a private party. And I knew it wasn't. So I said to him, what's that all about? And he said, yeah, I could tell they were dressed like knuckleheads. So I wasn't letting them in. And what looked like the right dress code to him was, at the time, if you had dreads or if you looked, you know, whatever, like alternative in some way, shape, or form. A lot of the myth about black-on-black crime was used to allow certain kind of developments, certain kind of cultural changes happen, and all sorts of stuff like that. So growing up in the 80s, and being here in the 90s until now, you heard a lot about why certain events couldn't happen because black on black crime has gotten out of control, and it's just not true. Because I watched those debates just to see what everybody was watching. One thing that was mentioned was like, okay, in Chicago, 4,000 people died in the last 8 years or something like that.
The number kept changing and the time frame kept changing as they were saying those numbers. It was fascinating.
Those numbers are roughly true. However, in the 1970s, if you look on Wikipedia, it was twice as many. It was twice as many in the mid-1970s. So the point is, the idea black on black murder is rising is a bill of goods.
It's a false notion.
That we've been sold. And that's been sold to us not only by the right wing, but like, you know, supposedly conscious rappers who were rapping and telling us about how we're doing the killing ourselves. And when in reality, then what I was just talking about was just Chicago. But overall, CDC statistics show that in 1950, there was a third more black-on-black killings than there were today. And in 1970, there was 75% more black-on-black killings than there were today. And it's gone down steadily since 1970. So in the 80s, when we're hearing all this stuff about crime and Bloods and Crips and all that kind of stuff, it was all hoopla. There was less black-on-black killings in the 80s than there were in the 60s. You know? So this idea of black-on-black crime ends up forming these questions like, well, why are people doing this and what's going on and what's wrong with the culture that's making us do these things? So we're asking the wrong questions because we've got faulty information about what's actually happening. And yeah, the truth is people do know folks that have died. Yeah, you can get a lot of anecdotal evidence and a lot of it is very sad. But that same sad anecdotal evidence and more was happening during the time of the Civil Rights Movement, during the 1950s, during the 1940s. Yeah, there were just as many grieving mothers during the Civil Rights Movement, during all these other things. And the news did try to say, oh, they shouldn't be talking about civil rights. They should be dealing with what's happening in their own communities and how they're keeping themselves down. But people didn't buy all of that because black folks probably didn't believe the media as much as we do now.
Yeah, the media is a very pervasive force in ways that it hasn't been in the past, with social media, with smartphones, with various technology, which looks a lot different than just having, say, news broadcasts at, you know, 5, 6, 10, 11, and going out and buying the newspaper. Not that those things weren't also deceptive, but the inundation with news is really different.
It's almost 10 o'clock. See, I got a ball of lip for property, so I slip my beanie on sloppily and promenade out to take up a collection. I got game like I read the directions. I'm wishing that I had an automobile as I feel the cold wind rush past. But let me state that I'm a hustler for real, so you know I got the stolen bus pass. Just as the bus pulls up and I step to the rhythm, so lady looked like she drank a 40 or 50. I see my old school partner say his brother got popped. Pay my respects, can you ring the bell? We came to my stop. The street light reflects off the piss on the ground, which reflects off the hamburger sign that turns round, which reflects off the chrome of the BMW, which reflects off the fact that I'm broke. Now what the fuck is new? I need loot. I spot the motherfucker in the tweed suit. I'm in his ass quicker than a kick from a grease boot. Eased up slow and discreet. Could tell he was suspicious by the way he slid his feet. Didn't wanna fuck up the come up, so I smiled with my eyes, said, hey, how's it hanging, guy? Bumped into his shoulder, but he passed with no reaction. Damn, this motherfucker had hella Andrew Jacksons. I'm a thief, a pickpocket, give a fuck what you call it. Used to call them fat cats, I just call them Wallace. Getting federal, ain't just a klepto. MasterCard and Visa, I gladly accept those. Sneaky motherfucker with a scam, know how to pull it. Got a mirror in my pocket, but that won't stop no bullets. Story just begun, but you already know. Ain't no need to get down, shit, I'm already low. Steps echo in the darkness, my teeth clenched tight like a fist in the cold sharp mist. I look down and I hear my stomach growling. Step to Burger King to attack it like a Shaolin. I never pay for shit that I can get by doing dirt. Linger to the girl cashier and start to flirt. All up in her face and her breath was like murder. Damn, the shit I do for a free hamburger.
What, you got my number? You gonna call me tonight?
It depends, it's them burgers attached to a price. I'm just kidding, I'ma call, even write you love letters. Thanks for the burgers, hook me up with a Dr. Pepper.
That's cool, you want some ice?
Yeah, and some fries would be hella nice.
Damn, my manager is coming, play it off, okay? Have a nice day.
I'm about to hear anyway. I use peoples before they use me. Cause you could get got by a Uzi over OZ. That's what a OG told me. Got to find someplace warm and cozy to eat the vittles that I just got. Came to an underground parking lot. This place is good as any.
Fuck it, it's all good. Walked in, found a car, hopped and set up on the hood. Ate my burger, threw back my cola. Somebody said, hey, it was a rental pig, I thought it was a roller. Want me to call the cops? I don't want them to see me. Looked down, saw that I was sitting on a Lamborghini. It was roses, Ferraris, and Jags by the dozen. A building door opened, damn, it was my cousin. Getting off of work, dressed up, no lie. Tux, cummerbund, and a black bow tie. Was like, hey, who is it? Me. Oh, what's up, man? I just quit this company. They hella racist and the pay was too low. I said, right, what was up in there, though? A party with rich motherfuckers. I don't know the situation. I know they got cabbage and all the corporations. IBM, Chrysler, and shit is what they said. Just then, a light bulb went off in my head. They be thinking all black folks is resembling. Give me your tux and I do some pocket smelling. Finna change in the bathroom and I freeze off my nuts. Let's take a short break while I get into this tux. Damn. All right, I'm ready. Like a million bucks, I'll be the flyest motherfucker in the Afro in a tux. My arm is at a right angle up, silver tray in my hand. May I interest you in some caviar, ma'am? My eye shoots round the room there and here, noticing the diamonds in the chandelier. Background Barry Manilow, Copacabana, and a strong ass scent of stogies from Havana. What no place where a brother might been. Snobby old ladies drinking champagne with rich white men. Alright then, let's begin this. Nights like this is good for business. 5 minutes in the mix, notice several different clicks talking, giggling and shit with one motherfucker in betwixt and everybody else jacking him, throttling. Found out later he on Coca-Cola bottling. Talking to a black man, who's he confused? Me looking hella bougie, ass all tight and sedity. Recognize him as the mayor of my city, who treats young black men like Frank Nitti. Mr. Coke said to Mr. Mayor, you know we got a process like Ice-T's hair. We put up the funds for your election campaign. And oh, waiter, can you bring the champagne? Our real estate firm says opportunities arousing to make some condos out of low-income housing immediately. We need some media heat to say that gangs run the street and then we bring in the police fleet. Harass and beat everybody till they look inebriated. When we buy the land, motherfuckers will appreciate it. Don't worry about the urban leaguer, Jesse Jackson. My man that owns Marlboro donated a fat sum. That's when I step back some to contemplate what you know. Sat down, wrestle with my thoughts like a sumo. Ain't no one player that could beat this lunacy. Ain't no hustler on the street could do a whole community. This is how deep shit could get. It reads macaroni on my birth certificate. Puttin' Tang is my middle name, but I can't hang. I'm getting hustled, only knowing half the game.
Hey, what's happening? This is Boots Riley. You're listening to Poetic License on KBOO, Portland.
In the 90s here in Oakland, we had bands on hip-hop. Actually, they had bands on hip-hop all over the country. A guy named Billy Jam was keeping track of that at the time. And so in the mid-90s in Oakland, you couldn't throw a hip-hop party unless you were a venue, which, again, there weren't many of those, and the ones that existed weren't having hip-hop shows unless you were like a gigantic artist. So to throw anything else, you needed to get a permit, and the police were not giving out permits for anything that had to do with hip-hop. Tupac, as much as people talk about he was from Oakland, he couldn't do a show in Oakland. We couldn't do shows in Oakland.
Yeah, when I saw Tupac in concert, it was like one of those large summer jams that was happening at, was it the Shoreline Amphitheater? Is that what it's called? Yeah. Mountain View?
Yeah. So bands like that were supported by not only developers, but certain segments of black city leadership. Matter of fact, it was a black mayor at the time. But what they sold to people was this idea of development, that these are things that are hindrances to development and us getting these companies in that will provide tax dollars and so on and so forth. So now we've got Oakland with great bike lanes and all that kind of stuff, but none of the people that used to ride bikes because they couldn't afford cars are able to enjoy it.
And this, of course, is happening all over the country, because as you say this, you know, even though the demographic of black people looks really different in Oregon and in Portland, it's the same story. Especially when you say that part about the people who rode bicycles because it was economical. Now there are bike lanes throughout North and Northeast Portland, but they weren't put there for us. they were put there for, you know, the folks that, you know, were able to afford moving in. So one of the many things that I love about the coup is that you perform with a live band. Can you tell me a little bit about how the band came together?
As you know, because you were one of the people, we've always had live instruments on our records since the very first album. Only the drums were pre-programmed. So we had a lot of musicians, and we couldn't take people on the road who weren't making enough on there. So starting in about 98, though, we started taking people on the road that had been playing with us, and including drums. And that came about from just the folks, again, that we've been working with. We had like a group of maybe 12 people that would go in and out and do different shows, but that all played together separately, because there's a scene of folks that in the Bay Area, in Oakland specifically, that make their money playing at churches, you know, but they then play on people's albums and things like that. And they all, they play together. So they kind of have some rapport. And so for a while we had it like 12 different people that would come in and out, and we'd have six people on stage. But I think starting in around 2004, it solidified started solidifying into who was coming in and on and off the stage into one thing. But yeah, I think I started doing live instruments just because I wanted to have a different mix. I didn't want that kind of East Coast sound where they've got a sample and then they've got to throw the drums way louder on top, and then the voice is somewhere floating over that. I didn't like that sound. I think maybe was at first trying to get more of a Dr. Dre sound, but, you know, even though I know I didn't get anywhere near that, which he used a lot of live instruments too.
How did Silky join the crew? How'd you come across Silky?
She started performing with us in like 2003. I knew her from 1999. She actually won this contest on MTV to have her video played and all this kind of stuff. She won a contest as a rapper where KRS-One actually said on that show, I forget what the name of it was, but it was like, that's the best female rapper I've ever seen. And he said, and so she had these videos that would play. So I met her in 99. And then I think in 2002, a friend of mine, Martin Luther, had her singing on his album. And I was like, who is that sounds like Tina Turner? And he was like, oh, that's Silky. Like, oh, she needs to change her name because there's already a rapper named Silky. But the point is, she hadn't told anybody that she also sang. So,
nice. Yes.
So then that's how that came about. I asked her to come sing on some stuff in the studio, and she ended up performing with us.
And one of the many songs that she's on that I love, it's on Pick a Bigger Weapon, is Baby Let's Have a Baby Before Bush Do Something Crazy.
Baby, let's have a baby before Bush do something crazy. Baby, let's have a baby before Bush do forward.
still got love to share. But you know I stopped smoking squares. Baby, let's have a baby before Bush do something crazy. Baby, let's have a baby before Bush do something crazy. I don't want the world to know before we get a chance to let our love grow. I don't want the world to know before we get a chance to let our love grow.
Two terms of President Barack Obama, and I'm curious, you know, coming into this election and this next 4-year term, or potentially 8, what concerns, expectations, thoughts that come to you in this upcoming election season?
One of the things that happened while Bush was in office is that people were very outwardly against the war. But put it all on Bush. And then there wasn't really much of a movement to say anything about the warlike attacks and the war that Obama was waging. And, you know, and because people decided to give him a pass. And that's what happens with many Democratic presidents. People don't come out as much. People don't voice their opposition to what's going on in the world, right? And often what would be a more radical movement turns into a vote the Democrat in movement. We saw that with the first anti-war movement, the first anti-Iraq war movement that turned into a pro-Kerry movement. And then it got that whole movement got dissipated because it got turned into a pro-Kerry movement. Then it built up again to a pro-Obama, it built up again to an anti-war movement, and that got turned into a pro-Obama movement. And since then, you know, you haven't seen a whole lot of worry about whatever wars the U.S. is in. And so my big concern is that people put a lot of their energy into these elections and a lot of faith in the outcome of them and lose sight of the fact that that no matter who is elected, you can make whatever politician do what you want if you have a mass militant radical movement. I mean, affirmative action came in under Nixon, not because he was a good person, but because there was mass movement happening and they needed to do that as a compromise. You know, even, you know, the civil rights legislation didn't happen because there was this big movement by radicals who said, okay, we got to get JFK elected. No, it happened because people joined these movements and they were afraid of it turning into something else. My fear is every election allows us to lose sight of what actually makes change in the world.
Upping your dollars with telekinesis. I done tried every day and that shit decreases. Anti-crime bill pieces. We need cash and that's the anti-thesis. I'm pro-overthrow of the hip-hop nation. Pro-laying low till I'm off probation. Pro-people control of the cash and corporations. Pro-prophylactic, yet pro-creation. Anti-watered-down drinks in fancy cups. Anti-promoters who don't ante up, but I'm not anti-club. I know that power is the most effective anti-drug. I'm pro-Zapatista, pro-Cuba, viva. Polarizer saying fuck La Migra. Policia say assassina. Let me show you what I mean. I'm anti-Republican and Democratic. If they self-destruct, that's anticlimactic. Tired of being honey like an antelope. Take the system by the throat, that's the antidote. So I pose a proposition. Take a look, be in support of opposition. Then be proactive, proceed with confidence. Cause you know that you can't change shit by riding the fence.
Ride the fence. Now you don't really wanna ride the fence. Now do you really wanna ride the fence? But would you really wanna ride the fence? Don't ride the fence. Ride the fence. Now you don't really wanna ride the fence. No, would you really wanna ride the fence? But would you really wanna ride the fence? Don't ride the fence.
This is Boots Riley. You're listening to the Sweet Sounds Poetic License on KBOO Portland.
And that song was Ride the Fence off of the album Party Music.
It was great to see you recently when I was in California, especially since usually when we see each other it's after a show. Bunch of people are standing around asking you really ridiculous questions and whatnot. And so I just wanted to mention that, you know, here you are, you're performing all over the world. You've, you know, been part of multiple albums, worked with various musical groups and lots of projects. And yet, you know, you're not a flashy person. You're not riding in a luxury car, you know, and flossing, which many people tend to associate with folks that are involved in hip hop and are hip hop artists.
Give me a chance to get some money before, at least give me a chance to sell out before commend me for not selling out.
Oh, and see, what I was going to ask you is how you managed to stay so down to earth.
Yeah, it's managed for me. The truth is, if I did get $1 million, it would all be spent on various projects that I want to see happen already. So, you know, which wouldn't be on myself. I might make it so that I'm not still constantly worried about making rent happen. But it's just about what I got into it for in the first place, you know. I have so many plans of what needs to get done that it wouldn't be able to get spent on the luxury car or anything like that. You know?
Now if you're getting in my car, don't sit down right away, cause the passenger seat tilts sideways. And don't even try to lean the shit back, the whole damn thing will fall off the track. Stick your hand out and signal for a ride. My window stuck, plus I got a broken turn light. Now I ain't dipping, sometime I get a stuck brake. Got my rear view attached with some duct tape. Keep your knee right there. I'm trying to keep that glove compartment closed, player. The seatbelt don't work, just tie around your waist. If you crash through the window, just cover your face. The radio, get one station on AM. It's Chinese, but if you listen, you can catch what they saying. Stop complaining, I heard what you said. So what the C-spring poked you in the leg? Didn't know it stabbed you, but what you stopping for? You finna put your foot through that hole in the floor. Man, you ain't nothing but a whiner. I almost swerved into them bushes and scratched up the primer. Yeah, I know it's two shades. I'm finna paint it money green when I get paid. Now what you say, you gon' sue me? Oh, because the baby hurt his leg and got a booby. Now your feelings hurt, you wanna get up out my shit. Cool, motherfucker, here you go, get your kicks. You need to act a little older. If you want that door to open, you gon' have to use your shoulder. Get the fuck up out, fool, you lose, why? My car is better than your shoe.
You get my pocket, baby. You got shit on the floor. And I ain't got no license, you know. I'm trying to knock the pow-pow. Well, if you get my pocket, baby. You got shit on the floor. And I ain't got no license, you know. I'm trying to knock the pow-pow.
See me in the town, you might think I'm a star. Every 3 months in a different car. Like the other day in the 81 Datsun. With my alternator rolling shotgun. Or in the fall in the 88 Seville. Pushing it with my foot down the hill. Once I did a job, the lady didn't want to pay me. So she offered me a hoopty instead. I said maybe. Cause it looked like it went through a war. Missing a door. 3 out of 4 ain't bad. But is it safe to drive? I wait to pay that and make it live. Beat first, cause that's my choice. A bucket with the beat look like a Rolls Royce. Next week it broke down on the Bay Bridge. And let me tell you, that motherfucker dangerous. Had 100, so I hit the auction block off. Got a 7.6 Pinto with some knockoff. Catching buses be getting me to work late. And you know that slowed down my pay rate. Down to 0. No alignment make it kinda hard to steer though. They need to pay me for all these adventures. Tell them to my grandkids when I got dentures. Making a buck really cost a buck 50. Selling that cheap if your car's shitty. Motherfuckers laughing but it beats the AC Transit Blue. Shit, my car is better than my shoes.
That was Cars and Shoes off Steal This Album by The Coup. I'm Taria Autry, and you are tuned in to KBOO Portland and another episode of Poetic License. And I am so pleased to be bringing to you this interview with Boots Riley from The Coup.
And I've had things put in front of me that would have made life easier, but it would have also made people hear my music in certain ways, like, you know, that would have negated all of that stuff. So, you know, like, we got offered a bunch of money to make Magic Clap the Taco Bell theme.
Oh my gosh. That,
you know, like,
yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that was pretty easy, you know, to do, like, as far as, you know, I definitely don't want that to happen. But it also, I also realized that no matter what that corporate connection was, even if it was somebody that could justify that, it would make people hear that song and my music differently, you know? Like, not even just, I'm not talking about just progressive and radical folks that are like, oh, fuck, why did he do that? But just average everyday people that might hear it and then they listen to that song and connect it with Taco Bell, you know?
Right.
So
it's a very different representation.
You know, it would destroy the reason that I'm doing that. And so, and that might even go for the rest of other songs that they hear. So then it would just, you know, mess up all of this other work that I did.
Well, I'm not pleased at your financial turmoil or economic circumstances not being, you know, as ideal as you might like. I am really thankful and appreciative of, you know, the integrity with which you create music and, you know that in my workout mix and, you know, in my day-to-day life, oftentimes it's your voice and the music of the coup that, you know, helps me get through the day and remember, you know, that, you know, there's good things out there. So I definitely appreciate you for that. Thank you. You were working on some projects with Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been working on through that?
I wrote this screenplay that we're making into a movie. I'm directing it. We're filming it in late February. It's a surreal, dark comedy with magical realism and science fiction inspired by my time as a telemarketer. It's called Sorry to Bother You.
Sounds incredible.
We're making a new album that will be the soundtrack to the movie. The score for the movie will be done by Tune Yards, actually.
Now, if people who are listening to this want to keep track of where you're performing and what you're up to and when these things are getting released, where's the best place for them to find out more information about what you're up to?
The Coup has a Facebook page, and the movie, Sorry to Bother You, has a Facebook page. There's a Boots Riley Facebook page, and then there's Boots Riley Twitter and Boots Riley Instagram.
So I want to thank you so much again for taking some time to join me on Poetic License here on KBOO Portland. And thanks to everyone for listening to this episode. And if you want to check out more episodes, you can visit my website at TuriaAutry.com. That's TuriaAutry.com.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, let's. What are we doing?
Let's do this.
This is KBOO Portland, listener powered non corporate community radio.
ABU Community Radio is a proud co sponsor of Full Gallop, produced by Brian Wilkerson. The play runs through Saturday, October 8th at the Sanctuary at Sandia Plaza in Portland. Full Gallop is a portrait of Diana Greenland.
Hello, I'm Bill Curtis, inviting you to KBOO Portland. Get ready, Portland. It's time for the UBU Hour.
Radio Theater!
On KBOO. Stay classy, Portland.
Thanks. That's fantastic. All right. Actually, we should go. Thank you so much. That's
yeah, we're going to have a rehearsal here.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You, and then you have a... like a